Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Secret War of Julia Child, a novel by Diana R. Chambers. Narrated by Candace Joyce. The Secret War of Julia Child is a work of fiction inspired by my admiration for Julia McWilliams Child. It is a product of my imagination, based on 10 years of extensive research across a myriad of disciplines and historical resources. From this material, I extracted various hints, allusions, and suggestions that fed my personal interpretation of Julia's little-known but formative OSS service in World War II Asia. However grounded in the reality of this period, my novel is only a story. I did want to be a spy, and I thought I'd be a very good one, because no one would think that someone as tall as I would possibly be a spy. Julia Child, on Fresh Air with Terry Gross, 1989 broadcast, WHYY and NPR. The employee agrees to keep forever secret this employment and all information which she may obtain, and to assume absolutely all risks incident to this employment. OSS Special Operations Contract. A major from Washington told us we were going to London and that we would be engaged in secret intelligence work for OSS, but that should anyone ask, we were merely to say we did clerical work. Catherine Keene, Memoir of Service in WAC or WAAC, WAC, Papers of Catherine Mildred Keene. Santa Barbara, California, September 2002. Julia turned her face into the hot Santa Ana wind, which had swept in as if it owned the place, whipping the linen curtains, aerating the small room like a cook whisking cream. Beyond were masses of white peaks rising from the blue Pacific, a fearsome force that could turn bleak and threatening in a moment, or mournful, or sparkling with promise. She'd seen every one of those moods during her ship's March 1944 passage into the unknown. On those far shores, her life had really begun, which was to say, she began to live, even amid the darkness that was World War II. It was in Asia that her taste buds came alive, all her senses, to be frank. Every day was a discovery. Here, from her desk, where a characterless computer had replaced her trusty old Royal, she filled her lungs with the tangy scents of sage, eucalyptus, jasmine, and sweet peas, which transported her to the Kunming Flower Circle and the outdoor market where she'd bought the garter belt and stockings. Shocking, wasn't it? Not what you'd expect from Julia Child. However had she become an icon? That had surprised even her. To her audiences, she was a dear friend, a favorite teacher, or an aunt. They invited her into their homes and watched her television show, tried her recipes. It was her great pleasure to have been part of their lives, shared her passion for good French food, and wished them bon appétit. They told her they felt as if they knew her. But they knew Julia Child, the French chef. That was her creation. Julia McWilliams was a born performer, and writer, and director, producing costume dramas in her family's Pasadena attic. The lanky leader of the neighborhood pack, Julia was well cast as a buccaneer, less so the delicate romantic lead. Then, too, there was the voice, inherited, like her height, from Mother Caro. The way it swooped and fluttered entirely out of her control, well, it used to pain her no end, until Paul advised her to relax and simply be. To know you is to love you, he'd told her eons ago in China, when he finally came to see her charms. Her husband had been her rock and inspiration, until a long illness carried him away. With him went half her heart. The other half, surprisingly, continued to beat, and she continued to be Julia Child. People depended on her and loved her. It wasn't the same as Paul's love, but it sustained her. That and a good roast chicken, a hearty burgundy, and fresh, crusty bread. Yet she often doubted she could carry on, or that it was worth it. Then she would hear her mother's firm counsel, "You must keep your chin up and move forward." So she had to. She'd always known she was meant for something, a belief she had confided to her girlhood diary but not dared proclaim aloud. Now she had crossed into the 21st century, where it was normal for a young woman to be ambitious. Few could imagine the shame she'd felt at wanting to achieve. Paul helped her break through that nonsense, too. When they moved to Paris, he encouraged her to stand up to those pompous male chefs and keep at it. How hard she'd worked. But she did it. Imagine mastering the art of French cuisine and bringing it to the world. Yet she would not have become that woman without her experiences in the cauldron of World War II, where she'd learned what she could really do. Memories of those days still had the power to shake her. The war demanded everything of them, and so they gave everything. Some of them survived, but none were ever the same. Simply put, the war made her. It was a path that still astonished her. The dreams and stubborn will that put her there, the chances she took. If she hadn't dared reach for that frontline post in Asia and stepped into the unknown, she would have never met the man of her life, Paul Child. She would have become someone else, not Julia Child. Part 1. Keeper of the Secrets. 1. Washington, D.C., September 1943.
Cowboys, General Wild Bill Donovan's foes called the intrepid OSS operatives who served their nation around the globe. Adventurers, even daredevils. Yet how could that be a bad thing when you had the world to save? Julia was proud to be doing her bit at the Office of Strategic Services, America's first intelligence agency, created by Donovan under President Roosevelt's mandate. A World War I Medal of Honor winner, he often proclaimed, "You can't succeed without taking chances." But as she darted out of headquarters into the moist September evening, she understood the difference between Donovan and herself. She was not a wounded colonel charging enemy fire. She was Julia McWilliams, supervisor of the OSS Registry of Secret Documents and Files. Yet her boss wasn't there, and she was, with the lives of thousands of good souls in her hands. Pausing at the top of the steps, she surveyed the circular entrance drive. A few parked vehicles, not a taxi among them. Set on an isolated knoll above the Potomac River, the old stone complex was dark and quiet, wispy clouds obscuring the crescent moon. A perfect setting for a spy novel. This was not fiction, though. She was taking an enormous risk now, following her conscience into an unauthorized mission. There would be consequences. The shadows parted. She jumped.
"Leaving before midnight?"
the armed sergeant asked. His Massachusetts accent, reminiscent of her late mother's, had brought forth a sense of tenderness toward the earnest young man who chafed at his rear echelon duty. Julia understood the feeling. She, too, yearned to get out into the world.
"Dinner date,"
she replied, her voice rising as she tried to conceal her nerves.
"Haven't eaten all day."
"Have a martini for me, doll, with two olives. You can count on it."
Julia waggled her fingers, uncomfortable with the subterfuge, while also imagining herself inside the character of a real operative. She felt on the verge of a larger life, challenging and dangerous.
Preparing to hotfoot it to E Street for a taxi, she was halfway to the entry drive when out of the darkness a dazzling yellow cab came rolling up. Adrenaline surged through her body. As a suit-clad leg emerged, she raised an arm and dashed for the door. The civilian caught her eye and held it. Then, emerging from a clump of shrubby dogwoods, two army officers hopped in. One flicked a cigarette butt out the window. Was she invisible? Or merely outranked? Before they could make their getaway, she leaned in.
"Excuse me, sir, I've an emergency at Georgetown Hospital. My little brother," she improvised, hand over beating heart. She only hoped Mother Caro wasn't viewing her duplicity from above.
"He's army, too. A training accident. I'd be grateful if you could give me a lift."
"Sorry, sister, we've a train to catch."
The jug-eared lieutenant frowned.
"But for an army man, least we can do is drop you part way. Get in."
Sliding into the front seat, she made a private apology to her not-so-little brother, John McWilliams III, serving somewhere in occupied France. Her fears for him fueled her anxiety over the phone call she'd just taken from an agent who identified himself as Dan O'Connell of the SI Division, Secret Intelligence. His raw whisper reverberated through her brain. "I have actionable intel." The last one in the office, she'd been clearing her inbox when a pimpled messages fellow handed her a decrypted cable from the OSS station in Bern, Switzerland. "Alarming report, re-final solution." Noting the time, Julia logged it in, then scanned the text. Her stomach turned. She lurched to her feet, crossing the anteroom to Donovan's inner sanctum, where she propped the message against his red telephone. He would not miss it when he returned from the Marlene Dietrich war bond rally. Then the red telephone rang. Startled, she stepped back. Julia could almost see the instrument throbbing with urgency. Its private number was known only to a few, including the boss's secret project agents. It was not her place to answer it. But there could be an emergency, life or death. She took a deep breath and answered the call. Now here she was, gesturing frantically on a Georgetown street corner where the yellow cab had dropped her en route to Union Station, but still some distance from the O'Connell meeting farther uptown. As the taxis shot by, she kept hearing the secret agent's final words. "If I don't see you before 1 hour, you'll be responsible for the deaths of thousands of good souls."
"To heck with you!"
Ignored by another cab, Julia hurried north toward the hospital. This was not the first time she'd been tested since snagging a clerical job last December at the new Office of Strategic Services, which Donovan had staffed with some of the nation's most brilliant, unconventional minds, including Ivy Leaguers, movie directors, and safecrackers. Women, too. Her boss lived life full tilt. He had a photographic memory, a voracious work ethic, and the Irish gift of gab, ready to chat up everyone from the shoeshine man to President Franklin D. Roosevelt to her. Challenged by the creative ferment, she gave it her all. Under clotted clouds that had swallowed the moon, she checked her Hamilton wristwatch again. Only 13 minutes left. Suddenly, the cobblestones were coming up at her as she caught the tip of one of her loafers, men's, worn in lieu of the rare 12A women's. Angrily righting herself, she hurried past a thriving Victory Garden, its corn stalks towering over even her. Her throat tightened. It came upon her sometimes, being so tall and ungainly, so different. Never the girly girl, always the pal. "So what?" Mother Caro used to declare throughout her high school years, insisting that Julia's time would come. Soon she'd be back east at Caro's alma mater, Smith College, making lifelong friends, writing and staging plays, skiing, maybe also captaining the basketball team. Then, on to achieve her dream, becoming a great woman writer. Julia McWilliams was free. That was more important than any boyfriend. First, live. She powered on, propelled by the long legs her mother had passed down, along with her copper curls, strong opinions, and free spirit, her name itself. A Mayflower blue blood, Julia Carolyn Weston McWilliams, Caro to everyone, had bequeathed Julia to her firstborn. As Georgetown Hospital drew into view, her sky-blue dress stuck to her back, and her hair was a frizzy mess. After smoothing herself out, she flung open the door and made a beeline to the front desk.
"I'm here to see Dan O'Connell."
She reined in the emotions that often sent her voice fluttering. Her white cap bobby-pinned to salt-and silver hair, the nurse checked her register. Down the hall, up the stairs, then the last corridor. Visiting hours are almost over. One patient was asleep. The other regarded her with fevered impatience. O'Connell, his bandaged right leg hanging from an overhead device. His left foot was propped on a black briefcase.
"Julia McWilliams," she said,
flashing her blue and white OSS ID. His face stubbled with dark beard. He looked disreputable. Perhaps that's his cover?
"What's this about?"
"The chief borrowed me from SI Scandinavia for a special op."
He squinted at her as if to make sure she understood the gravity of his words.
"A few hours ago, I'm heading to meet my contact when some jerk backs into me, smashes me against a parked truck."
Given the situation, she had to consider the worst.
"Was he trying to stop you?"
"I thought I was clean, but..."
O'Connell shrugged angrily.
"Next thing I know, I'm in an ambulance fighting the medics for this."
He tapped his heel on the scuffed briefcase. Whatever this contained was driving the man. Julia nudged her chair closer.
"I sympathize, Mr. O'Connell. The general will get on it first thing tomorrow."
"Tomorrow's too late. My contact is leaving the country tonight. Even if I could break out, I'd never make it in time."
He scowled at his bum leg.
"Union Station is our final fallback. I need someone there."
His burning black eyes met hers.
"You're it."
"Oh my."
She stared back, electrified. After Pearl Harbor, the intelligence failure that led to the birth of OSS, a Japanese sub had surfaced off the Santa Barbara coast practically next door. Galvanized, she'd joined the aircraft warning service in downtown Los Angeles. Commuting in her 1929 Model A jalopy, Eulalie, over the new Pasadena freeway, she spent long hours surveilling air and sea. Proud to finally have serious work, she made her way to Washington, and before long, an OSS clerical job that shook her into new life. 18 months later, she was gatekeeper for America's spy chief. His keeper of the secrets with the highest security clearance. Every incoming cable, diplomatic pouch, and crumpled, mud-stained agent's report landed on her registry desk to be logged, cross-referenced, and channeled to the relevant unit, a locked file, or the boss's desk. She was hungry, though, to get out of the files and into the field to write her own reports. Her heart sped up, then stopped.
"I want to help you, but I could lose my job."
"Or get promoted,"
O'Connell interrupted in a barely audible tone.
"German telegraph traffic to occupied Oslo goes through Swedish leased cables. The Swedes, although officially neutral, broke their code and have been passing us intel."
Julia nodded, having seen many of these dispatches.
"This time there's a price tag, $50,000. But not for anyone's greed. The Nazis have issued a deportation order for Denmark's entire Jewish population to be interned, at best."
She stared, still appalled by the final solution cable from their Bern station chief, whose German informant had been invited to supply prussic acid for a prison in Auschwitz, Poland.
"And?"
"A giant rescue operation is underway to smuggle them across Öresund Strait to Sweden, where the king will grant asylum. Almost every boat in the land is being mobilized. Some are charging passage. Stockholm will transfer the funds to the Danish resistance."
He shot a meaningful look at the briefcase. While fearing the wrath of Donovan, she shared O'Connell's resolve.
This was her opportunity to make a difference. She raised her chin in assent.
My contact will board the midnight train for New York before flying on to Stockholm, he explained brusquely. The meet is at 23:45. There's vital intel in it for us.
What?
I was told only that there's a thank you from Swedish friends.
He shifted his leg off the case.
Open it.
Lifting the briefcase onto her lap, she undid its brass clasp and removed a large novel, Gone with the Wind. Her bookworm mother had owned the same edition. Rhett Butler carrying Scarlet in his arms, her heaving bosom a reminder of Julia's own feminine deficiencies. Fortunately, her gams...
No, open it.
Inside, a rectangular cutout held a stack of $100 bills about 2 inches high. The book felt hot in her hands. She swiftly closed and returned it to its case. Hearing the clasp's loud click, she glanced at the immobile patient in the other bed. Was he dead? Or playing dead?
My contact is unknown to me. He'll be at the end of the platform holding Assignment in Brittany by Helen McInnes. You'll hand him Gone with the Wind and say, here is the novel I promised. I wish you safe travels. He'll give you his book, saying, thank you, the same to you. Then he boards, and you leave.
O'Connell looked at the wall clock.
Union Station is always jammed. You're in no danger, but need to move fast. You have 50 minutes.
Outside the hospital, she nabbed a taxi vacated by a harried doctor.
I know everyone tells you they're in a rush, Julia told the graying driver. But I really am. It's a matter of national security.
She felt as if she'd stepped from the wings onto the stage. He eyed her through the rearview mirror. She returned a steady look. He hit the gas. A year ago, she had arrived at Union Station with 2 trunks, her portable Royal typewriter, and a passion to serve. Then the crowds had energized her. Now they were a hindrance to her urgent, life-saving mission. The whole world, it seemed, was on the move, but she had to give priority to the desperate Danish Jews. Patting her mother's pearls for luck, she hastened through the great domed concourse, gripping the precious briefcase. The tiled hall echoed with the clatter of feet and voices as masses of people milled about, their faces grim or impatient, shiny from the humidity that had followed them all inside. Elbowing through their midst, she passed a curly-haired traveler's aid volunteer showing a map to one of the uniformed men waiting 3 deep across her oval counter. They sat, slept, and smoked on packed wooden benches, coats and duffel bags at their feet, everyone going off to war, or already there. Americans will always fight for liberty, 1778 to 1943. The large poster, depicting 3 GIs backed by 3 revolutionary soldiers, had been designed at the Office of War Information. Thanks to her Smith history degree and a family connection, Julia had obtained her first Washington job at the OWI Research Department, where she'd typed file cards on every government official at record speed. After 2 months and 10,000 cards, she moved on to OSS. Wondering if the 2 army officers who'd commandeered her taxi would spot her, she headed for the departures board, which indicated the Manhattan-bound train was on time. The big clock read 11:39. 6 minutes till the rendezvous. 6 minutes to save thousands of innocent lives, children, their mothers and fathers, grandparents and cousins, from Nazi poison gas. Her sweaty hand clutched the leaden briefcase. The gate was swarming with military and civilian passengers rushing to board. Halfway up the platform, the person in front of her came to a dead stop, searching for his carriage. She almost crashed into him. Cutting off his profuse apologies, she pushed on. But there was no man waiting with a book, only a couple embracing, saying their farewells, and a tall, voluptuous blonde in a deep purple dress and mink cape. She was holding a book. Assignment in Brittany. Their eyes connected. Julia approached the fashionable woman. Seeing the expected title, she fumbled open the briefcase, and with a shaky hand,
reached for Gone with the Wind.
"Here is the novel I promised," she said, her voice waffling with nerves. "I wish you safe travels."
They exchanged books. "Thanks. The same to you." The agent offered an easy smile, which she then focused on a tall captain carrying an overnight bag. "Hey, good looking." As Julia lowered assignment in Brittany into the briefcase, the man with whom she'd nearly collided was staring. The embracing couple parted. One boarded, the other turned her way. Sweat trickled down her spine. "Keep your chin up and move forward," Caro urged. She strode down the platform, through the gate, and into the crowd, then threw herself into the next cab. Back at the Brighton Residence Hotel, she raced upstairs to her studio and jammed a chair against the door. Collapsing on the bed, she kicked off her penny loafers. Inside the McInnes novel was a similar cutout, containing a miniature Minix, a spy camera, carrying who knew what secrets. She placed it under her pillow, then flopped back, remembering her girlhood heroine, Nancy Drew. Overcome, she giggled. Pretty soon, she was shaking with laughter, hugging herself to keep silent. A matter of national security. Of all the plays she'd written, parts she'd enacted, this one took the cake. By the time her giddiness faded, she was drained, but utterly exhilarated. Stars shot through the blackness behind her eyes. Julia had never felt like this before and couldn't wait to tell her boss. Her actions might end up in Donovan's morning briefing for the president. Now she'd never sleep. 2.
"You what?"
General William Donovan rarely raised his voice, and as he did now, Julia flinched, feeling the force of his anger. Jaw tight, he regarded the tiny Minox camera on his desk. Lined up between them were his telephones, including his direct line to the president, and the red one, which she'd had the temerity to answer last night.
"I had to, sir. The lives of thousands of Danish Jews were at stake."
He tapped the red handset.
"You are not authorized to answer that phone."
Julia steadied herself, digging her fingernails into her palms.
"I'm sorry. We'd just received the Swiss cable about a Nazi final solution to the Jewish problem. I was putting it on your desk when the phone rang. I was pretty emotional, and I guess I had a feeling it was important."
"You guess?" he demanded in a withering tone. "In this business, feelings and emotions can be dangerous. Guesses can cost lives."
Julia cast her gaze to the floor, wanting to sink through it.
"Of course, you're right, I overstepped. But..."
She needed to make him understand.
"O'Connell said I had to pass operational funds to his contact at Union Station before midnight, that it was actionable intel. You were at the Dietrich Bond rally, not expected till later. There was no one else."
"The man is reliable," Donovan conceded.
Then his look hardened again.
"But you didn't know that, so don't try to justify yourself."
This could be it. The consequences she'd feared. Would he demote her back to the clerical pool? Or fire her? The end of everything she valued. Barely breathing, Julia waited to hear her fate. He frowned at the world globe on his desk.
"We suspect a leak somewhere between Stockholm and here, so I had O'Connell report directly to me. The German cable traffic is too critical to mess with."
Her heart raced.
"I knew I was taking a risk, but..."
He directed his focus back at her.
"Reckless behavior, McWilliams."
Under a thatch of silver hair, his bright blue eyes were dark and weary. Bill Donovan had little time for sleep, communicating with every time zone from HQ, or hopping around the globe on a Pan Am Clipper seaplane overseeing operations. He'd always seemed invincible, but Julia now glimpsed the man beneath the myth, human after all. While hating to cause him additional grief, She had to persist. Her actions had been necessary.
In exchange, the Swedes would pass us a valuable thank you.
She glanced at the Minox. He pushed it toward her with the curt order,
"Get this into processing."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?